You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We're proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, who's tending our crops during the pandemic? We're going to talk to Baldemar Velasquez of FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. Then, what happens when you lock down a country where most people earn their living day by day and there's no social safety net? Honduras, COVID-19 in a narco state. In the news, Missouri legislature, the good and bad, and the ugly. And really, is a trash company in New Orleans using convicts as scabs? Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. She'll remember the 1970 postal strike. Can't imagine why. Now for the news. And now for the news from our side, May 14th, 2020. The St. Louis Post reports that Missouri could offer no excuse mail-in ballots to all voters this year in an effort to ward off the spread of the coronavirus. That's if the state legislature, which is due to adjourn for the year or at least until a special session, see passing it as a priority. Yesterday, the Missouri House adopted a bill that would work like an absentee ballot, but it would not require voters to state a reason why they can't go to the polls on Election Day. It would only be available in the August and November statewide elections, not in the primary June 2nd. Voters would still have to get the ballot envelope notarized before it could be submitted, however, which continues to pose a real problem in a pandemic. Voters to request such a ballot in person, or voters can request such a ballot in person or by mail. The bill was sponsored by Republican Representative Dan Shaw of Imperial. It's House Bill 552, and it still has to pass the Senate. Currently in Missouri, to get an absentee ballot, you must state that you are incapacitated or confined due to illness. Secretary of State Ashcroft has said that fear of contracting the COVID-19 virus if you show up at the polls is not a sufficient reason to get an absentee ballot, and it's a felony to lie about your reason. Representative Deb Lavender, a Democrat from Kirkwood, opposed the bill because a notary is still required. The bill passed handily and was sent off to the Senate. Last month, when Governor Parson pushed elections back to June 2nd, he also issued an executive order allowing documents to be notarized over video chat. The change affects absentee ballots, which must be notarized unless the voter is in the military, permanently disabled, or confined because of illness.
Yesterday, the Missouri House also passed an amendment which will go on the ballot on the August ballot. It's trying to undo part of the Clean Missouri, which voters passed by a wide 62% margin in 2018. What got Missouri Republicans upset is that the part of the Clean that makes the redistricting of legislative seats nonpartisan. This occurs every 10 years after the census. Clean aimed at doing away with gerrymandering, which has made the Missouri legislature far more Republican than the voters are by designing districts to favor incumbents, especially incumbent Republicans. Sean Sodiker Nicholson, the father of Clean Missouri, calls the new rollback Dirty Missouri. In an email this morning, he predicted that voters will turn it down. He said, despite acknowledging that their own plan is riddled with errors, despite knowing that voters will hate it if it survives inevitable court challenges and appears on ballots later this year, while the politicians attempt to undo the voters' mandates and rig maps for the decade is very, very, very frustrating, we know that will be rejected in a statewide vote. The amendment, which was passed by a vote of 98 to 58 in the House, had passed the Senate earlier in the year. It is going to face challenges because it appears to not count children or non-citizens as part of the district, meaning that rural communities with far more older residents will get more political power in the legislature. So, Representative Dean Poulter, a DePere Republican, who sponsored the measure, called the 2018 vote partisan train wreck. That was designed to give Democrats more power in the General Assembly when new political maps are drawn after the 2020 census. He said it could result in House and Senate districts dividing communities. Missourians should have a choice, Poulter told the Post. Communities must be kept together.
This comes to us from WDSU News in New Orleans. In the middle of the pandemic, inmates from a work release program in Louisiana are being brought in to replace striking sanitation workers in New Orleans East. The sanitation workers walked off the job earlier this week, protesting pay and working conditions. The company says it's not unusual for them to bring in work release inmate labor to man their trucks. The company is Metro Service Group. It's contracted by the City of New Orleans to pick up trash in the eastern part of the city. Support for the sanitation workers has grown. Hospitality workers, healthcare workers, even residents are impacted by the coronavirus. We're on the line this morning voicing both concern and support. Zachary Kirkwood, a healthcare worker, said, "All of us, frontline workers, from sanitation workers to doctors and nurses and grocery store employees, all of us are putting our lives on the front line to make the city run, and we are being treated disposably and not well." Lita Farquhar, a union carpenter, said, "I've been thinking about these guys for a while, do their jobs without masks, any gloves. They need PPE, they need hazard pay, and they need higher wages in general." People on the line today said they'll be back until the workers get the pay they are looking for and the protection, too.
And finally, attorney Heather Schlossman, a sometime guest on this show, made Fox 4 News because she and a client, Nina Nguyen, are suing the Tabin Group in Overland Park for discrimination because Nguyen is Asian. Nguyen says her former employer singled her out because of her race during the coronavirus pandemic. Schlossman said that they believe that because she is Asian, she was creating a bigger risk for them to transmit the COVID-19. On that day, Nguyen was told to move 6 feet away from her coworkers for the safety and concerns over COVID-19. Nguyen claims that she was the only person in the office with a staff of 15 to 100 people asked to move. Schlossman thinks that the decision to move her client was a ground in ignorance. They didn't move anyone else, even a coworker who had possible exposure. Wynn complained to the staffing agency which hired her for her health insurance agency. They passed on her complaint and she was fired allegedly for being unhappy. Schlossman said that Tabin Group and Randstad are two options to try and resolve the allegations. They could either take advantage of the EEOC mediation or say nothing, which will give her grounds to file a lawsuit. A recent survey conducted for the Center of Public Integrity shows more than 30% of Americans have witnessed someone blaming Asian people for the pandemic. News was read by Judy Ansel and Christina Dismay.
It's a mighty long road that my poor hands have hold. My poor feet have traveled a long dusty road. Out of your dust bowl and westward we rode. Your deserts was hot and your mountains was cold. I worked on your orchards of peaches and prunes. Slept on the ground by the light of your moon. At the edge of your cities, you will see us, and then we come with the dust, and we're gone with the wind. California, Arizona, I made all your crops, but it's north up to Oregon to harvest your hops. Dig the beans from the ground, pick the grapes from your vines to set on your table, your light sparkling white.
When did you come to America the free? Who are your ancestors? What is your creed? Father and the son and the we. Where is the spirit that sought liberty?
When did you come to America? Long, long before, when the buffalo walked. When did your hands burn like coals? The thing that made this land your pride.
And that was Leela Downs with her medley on Pastures of Plenty, and I'm Judy Ansel. Baldomir Velasquez is in his 70s, but he's still the dynamic leader of FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, based in Ohio. When we think of farm unions, we often think of the United Farm Workers in the West, but Midwestern and Eastern farm labor are in FLOC. Not only does Baldomir play a wonderful folk guitar and have his own musical group, but he also got a MacArthur Genius Grant, several honorary doctorates, and serves on the AFL-CIO Executive Council. None of that fame and talent, though, has moved him from his mission, which is to migrant farm workers. He grew up as one in Texas in the Valley and traveled with his family to work the crops. In 1967, after getting a degree in sociology, he founded the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, or FLOC. FLOC's strategies in organizing powerful workers in a food system made up of multinational conglomerates have been unique and often quite successful. Welcome to the show, Baldomir.
Thank you, Judy. Appreciate it.
So you've been real busy lately. I want to get into how you're helping your members deal with this pandemic. But first, would you kind of give us an overview of the workers that FLOC represents? What crops are they in, and what kind of contracts do they have?
Well, we represent about 11,000 workers with collective bargaining agreements on between 650 700 small family farms. And most of those farms are part of a large growers association in North Carolina that's got an umbrella collective bargaining agreement. And so one of the features of that agreement that the majority of those workers are H-2A visa guest workers. And it just goes along with our outlook on organizing farm workers when the world was debating the legitimacy of these guest worker programs, you know, the idea of foreign workers taking American jobs. Agriculture is a lot different than hotel, poultry, and other processing food crops. And that is that these are hand laborers, harvest crops. These 11,000 workers harvest more than 30 different crops, ranging from tobacco, cucumbers, tomatoes, strawberries, wine grapes, sweet potatoes. Tobacco, of course, is one of the main crops that runs through the Deep South, and even cutting Christmas trees in November and December. So we've been able to negotiate supply chain agreements starting back with the Campbell Soup fight back in the 80s when we got Campbell Soup to collectivize all their small family farms that were their suppliers and bringing them into a multi-party collective bargaining agreement. And the key to this whole thing for us is demanding that the these global corporations, whether they be manufacturers, retailers, food chain stores, negotiate the prices of their commodities in the supply chain. Farm workers cannot get decent working and living conditions unless the farmers get a fair price to the corporations that they supply. And this has been the key to organizing farm workers in the Midwest and now the Deep South, and hopefully expand to the different parts of the East Coast.
It's such a fascinating strategy. You know, I remember that, well, I still have the T-shirt that my daughter got when she was 3 years old in the 1980s of a picture of a Campbell's soup can that says Campbell's Cream of Exploitation. I love that T-shirt. You should remake it. But anyway.
Collector's items now.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe I don't want to sell it. It's too good. Anyway, so, you know, the tactic of going after the big food corporations along with the farmers who supply them was something that you guys really invented. And it's very interesting that you're still following that kind of model, I guess. You have an agreement with the North Carolina Tobacco Growers Association, right?
No, that's a separate.
Oh, that's separate. Okay.
That's the North Carolina Growers Association, which is specifically set up to help their farmer members process the visas that they to get the workers that they need in their on their farms.
I see.
And it is a very an excellent model because. They, as part of the agreements of affiliation, is that they're joint employers, which means that we can transfer workers from one farm to the other. It's one of the dream demands that many reformers have pushed for in Washington, that workers who come with a visa have portability, that they're able not have to work for one individual farm. Because in most cases, with the H-2 visa, the worker is tied to that direct employer. And if he doesn't do everything that employer tells him to do, you're likely to get thrown back to Mexico. You just can't leave and work another farm because that'll make you an undocumented worker automatically.
Right. Of course, that's a very common problem with visa workers because you're afraid to complain about bad conditions because you can't change employers. Can you talk about the process? I know you started a document you sent me by saying that you were just at a meeting in March in Monterrey, Mexico, with a bunch of your members. To begin the process of bringing in workers. Can you talk about that process and that agreement that is an agreement, I guess, between the United States and Mexico, right?
Well, it is the H-2A visa program, and it employers have to prove that they can't get domestic workers by advertising and trying to find people to come and take the jobs when people don't respond. Then they applied to the Office of Foreign Labor Certification in Chicago, in the Department of Labor, and they authorized that this farmer has shown that he can't get domestic workers. So the order is sent to USCIS that makes the visas available at the American consulates in Mexico. And this, in our case, most of those visas are processed in Monterrey, Mexico. And that's why we set up an office in Monterrey to monitor and oversight the process of our members that are coming in under that visa. And let me tell you that many critics of this guest worker program are correct in their criticisms. There was a big study done by quite a number of groups have done studies on this. They've shown the Southern Poverty Law Center did a major study, shows that this is practically a slave labor program. And our thought on that is that while that's true, we're the organizers, we're not the politicians. We are to organize the unorganized regardless of their status. And that if this is a slave labor program, let's make it into a fair labor program. And you can do it by negotiating agreements with the employers that use that visa and put in safeguards to keep the what seems to be a chronic abuses in the program, mostly which start in Mexico when they're recruiting in. Because in the U.S., there's no way to have oversight of independent recruiters that work for North American farmers in their activities in Mexico. This is the first challenge that we had when we got the agreement with the growers in North Carolina. How do we stop the extortion of money for those visas in those, it's all over Mexico because they have recruiters in probably 9, 10, 11 different locations throughout Mexico, and some of them are very remote in the mountains of San Luis Potosí, Veracruz, Nayarit, Durango, Tlaxcala, so we only had to figure out a way to stop the extortion of that money, and which we think we have done successfully with the cooperation of the growers, the employers in North Carolina, because many of the abuses that happen, the grower has no idea that it's going on, but he gets blamed for it. Uh-huh. So, but through collective bargaining, we've been able to talk these things out and put in safeguards to keep that from happening.
Well, I know that you've paid a high price for that, too, because one of your organizers that you sent into Mexico was assassinated. Talk about the challenges farm workers face because of this pandemic?
Well, yes. Early on in March, actually, just soon as when we got done with our training in Monterrey on the 13th, 14th, 15th of March, we came back into the country and we started hearing from the first workers that they were starting to come. And those that were on a schedule to come in late March and in April to do the planting, the greenhouses and things like that. Yes, they were fearful. We immediately created a protocol, start educating the workers of the best science discussions that were going on at the time and what the medical people were recommending and what protocols to follow. The early distancing, hand washing, cleaning, were fundamental things. So we put that in a packet and started sending it to our members in Mexico even before they left their homes to come through Monterrey to watch out for overcrowded buses and large gatherings in Monterrey because they assemble outside the consulate. And so we did as much education as possible and tried to do education. We started an effort to collect cleaning supplies because we knew when they got here, you know, the local people did a run in the local stores to get those cleaning supplies, whether it's Clorox, sanitation wipes, and even toilet tissue and fundamental things, that the shelves were bare. So we collected many of those, and as the workers started to arrive, we told them, call us. we communicate with quite a few of them through social media, let us know, and we were perhaps better prepared than most other groups because we have a union and we can coordinate these things, and we're able to get supplies out to the labor camps. I personally took a truckload of supplies from Toledo to North Carolina, 3 weeks ago now? Mm-hmm. And we went out on the weekend and distributed supplies to workers in the labor camps.
Great. Well, you know, I have a copy of this COVID protocol that you were using to instruct the workers, and I just want to read one of them because it's just amazingly detailed. Number 10, this is of 19 points. The grower should require and pay for someone to clean the bus and other commonly touched surfaces at least daily. If this is not happening, advise the employer of these recommendations by the state government and or contact the union. So does this scare the employers? Do they actually comply?
Let me tell you the truth. The truth is that most of these farmers, and we're not talking about corporate growers here. We're talking about mom-pop, small family farms.
Uh-huh.
Most of them, well, all that I know of, I don't know of any that are deliberately not doing those things or don't want to do those things. I think if you look at it from their financial self-interest, that it's in their interest for their workers not to get sick. And if they can avoid their workers getting sick, they pay fees. They pay the inbound transportation fees to the association ahead of time. So they got money invested in those workers to be here. They don't want them sick and laying around. So they're going to do everything they can to keep them healthy.
Great.
But they struggle like a lot of us here who go to the store and they find the shelves bare of the basic cleaning supplies that you need. And so we're able to work well with those growers to help them get the things that they need for their workers. And in this regard, we have the same interest. And but we want the workers to notify us because, you know, a grower may be reticent to call us or communicate with us in any way. So we say to the members, hey, if you need to, call us, and we'll respond and do what needs to be done.
Well, I think you should really be complimented because I haven't heard of other unions taking that much trouble in order to protect their workers. I have one last question. We're just about out of time, Baldemar.
Sure.
President Trump says that he wants to cut wages for H-2A workers, which is pretty unbelievable in a pandemic. But anyway, that's what he says. And he also wants to cut back on the visas that they issue to the non-farm worker, H-2B workers. Do you think there's much chance of this happening? And can U.S. agriculture survive without foreign workers?
Not very much. When you talk about agriculture in the United States, particularly labor-intensive crops like vegetables and fruit, these are seasonal jobs. And I know that the mantra of most advocates on immigration and so on, they want people to get citizenship, a way to citizenship. While that is good, let me tell you, any agricultural worker that gets citizenship and wants to live in the United States, he's not going to stay in agriculture.
Right.
So there's going to be a void left there because if you live in the U.S., you're not going to make a living on part-time jobs the year round. And you'll want a full-time job to support your family. So you're going to lose that workforce if they all get citizenship. So there's always going to be a need for a temporary worker program. And the best, and not everybody that comes here to work wants to come to the United States. They want to go back home and build their life there. And if they can make some money here to build their life in Mexico. So there's going to be that void there, and we might as well organize it and have it work in an efficient way that helps the worker and hopefully keep the small family farmer alive.
Well, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I have a bunch of other questions, but I want to thank you for what you do because it's really an inspiration. So thank you so much, Baldemar Velasquez.
Very grateful, Judy. Thank you.
Yes. And stay tuned for
more on how COVID-19 in Honduras.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance, such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
KKFI is holding a virtual event on May 21st at 7 p.m. We invite you to join us online to watch the documentary film Rigged, The Voter Suppression Playbook, followed by a panel discussion moderated by Judy Ansel. She'll be joined by the filmmakers, Missouri Jobs with Justice, and ACLU of Kansas, talking about local efforts to expand the vote in Missouri and Kansas. This event is free, and when you RSVP at kkfi.org/rigged, you also get a link to watch the film ahead of time. It's May 21st at 7 p.m. to watch Rigged and learn from the panel. All the info is at kkfi.org/rigged.
On the next Thursday Night Special, How the Pandemic Has Affected the City. Join host Bob Groves for a broad look at how the pandemic has affected Kansas City. Local officials from public health, social work, therapy, education, infrastructure, immigration, environment, homelessness, and faith communities join Bob for a roundtable discussion on how we got here, how we're coping, and where we go from here. That's Thursday Night Special, 7 p.m.
All right, good evening. Welcome to the Heartland Land Forum. I'm Christina Disming. Tonight we're going to be talking to Karen Spring, coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network, and active human rights activist and researcher, about the current situation in Honduras surrounding the coronavirus. Thank you for joining us, Karen.
Thank you, Christina, for inviting me.
All right, so very first question that I have for you is, could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in activism in Honduras?
Sure. So I am Canadian, so I became very concerned with the role of Canadian mining companies in Central America. So after I graduated university, I moved to Central America, and then I went to Honduras to start supporting the Honduran social movements and communities right after the 2009 coup d'etat that saw the overthrow of the democratically elected government. And so my role was, and my interest in going there, was to invest in understanding of the United States and Canada, who supported both governments that supported the coup. And so that's sort of what has led me to stay there and to continue the work that I do.
Awesome. I mean, you've been there for a while. You've got a good grasp of how things have gone down south rather quickly after the coup, even with the election of Juan Orlando Hernandez. And for our listeners, his nickname is J-O-H, or Ho, so maybe referred to him as that throughout this broadcast. So a lot of things have happened in Honduras in the past 11, 12 years. Right now, the United States, we're having coronavirus that is happening. This crisis is happening. A lot of the focus, of course, is going to be what's happening here in the United States. And it seems like throughout the rest of the world, the media has gone silent about concerns that are happening in other countries, such as Honduras, for example, that we're talking about now. Could you tell our listeners a little bit of the situation, what the situation is like right now in Honduras?
Sure. So I think that's a really good point that you made, that there's a lot of focus on the U.S. and there's a lot of focus on the impact of the pandemic on countries like developed countries, which are, you know, the United States has taken quite a hit. It's been a very difficult situation for people across the United States with the uncertainty, the economic difficulties, obviously, that affect the most marginalized and the most excluded from society. And that's no exception for Honduras. And in fact, Honduras, as a developing country, quote unquote, obviously is experiencing the pandemic in a way that is even greater than a country like the United States, that's considered a wealthy nation, that's the quote unquote global superpower, because of the unjust global economic model that already exists in the world, even before the pandemic hit. So Honduras is not yet at the same moment in the pandemic as the United States is. So far there have been there's about 2,100 cases of COVID-19 in Honduras. But the problem is that there is absolutely no ability for the Honduran government to respond to basic issues in Honduras, like economic issues, unemployment, insecurity. And a lot of this was shown when Hondurans fled Honduras even before the pandemic in 2019 in caravans to the U.S. and the U.S. southern border. And so people were already fleeing a very difficult situation in Honduras. And with this pandemic, obviously all of the issues that contribute to a difficult social, economic, and political situation in Honduras are worsened by a pandemic. And the Honduran government really has no ability to respond, to support, provide basic health care, let alone the needs, meeting people's needs, food needs, just general sort of like public health measures to mitigate the spread of the virus. So the situation in Honduras is quite serious, and connecting it to the U.S. as well is that I think it's important that Americans know that while there's a pandemic going on and while Honduras is being hit just like everybody else is, all other countries are, the Trump administration has continued deporting people from the United States to Honduras. And so that's contributing to the spread of the virus as well in the country, as well as, you know, I guess in other Central American countries that are also receiving people that are being deported.
And I heard there was a report that there wasn't necessarily just Hondurans being sent back to Honduras, but also people from Liberia and from Congo, people who are not necessarily Honduran in origin. Have you known about that, or can you speak on that?
So the Safe Third Country Agreement, which is the agreement that the Trump administration came into, basically signed with the Central American countries, says that people that are seeking asylum from a whole bunch of different countries will be sent to Honduras or Guatemala to basically seek protection there. So it's a way that the Trump administration has skirted the asylum requests of many migrants from all around the world in the United States. And so the Safe Third Country Agreement actually came into effect in Honduras the day that the government, or 2 days before the government, locked down the country to stop the spread of the virus. There's a lockdown, a permanent and absolute lockdown. People are not allowed to leave their houses unless, except once every 2 weeks. And they partially suspended constitutional rights. And so sending people back to Honduras from the United States, from all these different countries, will definitely have a very serious impact on the country, especially since the country is not able to provide any sort of support on the best of days, let alone during a pandemic.
So these people who were dropped off, they weren't really given any support whenever they were finally dropped off from the United States to Honduras?
Well, the government says they've set up like big warehouses where they're putting migrants to basically quarantine. But it's not clear, because human rights defenders and lawyers can't circulate freely in the country because of the lockdown. There's probably been no oversight or ability to inspect those areas to even see if they're being used correctly and if proper measures are being implemented. There's a case of migrants that are at the border, the southern border of Honduras, that passed up from Nicaragua and, you know, southern and South America, from all these different countries. And they're basically sleeping in the streets, and they're not receiving any support from the government at all, despite the fact that there are these alleged migrant support centers that are basically closed.
You've mentioned multiple times that the Honduran government has no way of supporting its people. Probably back around last month or late March, that there was a report that U.S. gave over $2 million to Honduras to combat COVID-19 in the country. What happened to that money, and like, who did it go to?
That's a good question as well. We don't really know, to be honest. The media has reported that the U.S. embassy in the capital city, Tegucigalpa, gave ventilators and some biosecurity protection equipment to the hospitals and some other support equipment. The problem is that the United States government has consistently ignored the widespread corruption in the Honduran government. And there's been at least three big scandals in the last month that have been revealed that show that the money that is coming from outside of the country to support the Honduran government and the Honduran people for the COVID crisis, the money's not being used correctly. It's being stolen. Contracts are being given to companies that are associated with the president and his family and his political party. They're being overvalued, the contracts, so they're pocketing a lot of money. They're not being followed through, so they're partially implementing the commitments in the contracts and not fully. And so the problem is that the United States, once again, is sending taxpayers' dollars to Honduras, which sounds really good and it sounds great in theory, but in the reality is that money's not being, and it's been proven, you know, by corruption bodies that money's not being spent what they say it's being spent for, or it's being basically siphoned off and stolen by corrupt government officials.
And that's one thing we continuously support. We're giving U.S. aid to Honduras to support COVID, but also I know down Honduras that we have U.S. companies down there, large U.S. companies. Do you know what effect the COVID-19, the crisis, the big changes that have been happening in Honduras, how has that affected these large companies, but also talk about, do you know if it's affected smaller companies or smaller businesses as well?
Yes. Yeah, so there are several U.S. companies in Honduras, some in different industries. One of them that comes to mind is the sweatshop industry. So the textile and clothing industry, and they make like plain t-shirts and underwear and stuff like that. Hanes brand, Delta Apparel. There's also an electronic factory as well from Empire Electronics. And they've been doing different things as different companies, but mostly not protecting their workers. Instead of telling their workers if they don't come to work, then they're going to be fired, or the workers that have shut the factories down and the workers stay at home. And so what the company is doing is considering the time that they're staying at home as their like vacation time, which isn't the case at all. In the sense, one of the corruption reports of one American company that's based in Florida actually got an overvalued contract to purchase N95 masks and surgical masks to distribute to the healthcare system. And the contract was like, you know, thousands of dollars, like if not millions of dollars, it was overvalued. And so that U.S. company basically received like pocketed money from those sales from the Honduran government. There's other ones like fast food restaurants as well. Like there's a lot of U.S. fast food chains in Honduras, Burger King, Wendy's, McDonald's, a lot of those companies, and they're franchises, but they still have those names on them. Those American, you know, names like of these fast food restaurants, and they've laid off their workers and they're not paying them sort of any sort of benefits or like any sort of payments at all as they're staying at home during this lockdown at a time when workers need it the most, especially in Honduras, where there is no support, there is no tax benefit, there is no social security network to catch them if something happens.
And you've made it clear that there has been lack of support from the government, that when it comes to workers' rights, businesses, that there is a failure to support these people. If you know, like, which communities are struggling the most in Honduras, since there's no safety net, are there specific communities that are struggling the most, or are there other communities or groups of people that are faring better than others?
So I think the communities that are struggling the most, it would be very similar sort of phenomenon as is what's happening in the United States. So the communities that are the most marginalized, that experience the most racism, that experience the most social economic difficulties because of the unjust system that many countries live in and that exists on a global level. So in Honduras, the people that are most, you know, hit by a crisis like this pandemic are poor people, which in Honduras is, you know, 60% of the country lives in poverty, 30% lives in extreme poverty. And obviously indigenous communities are obviously more affected as well. They face a lot more structural racism and daily racism based on behaviors of state security forces and also public health authorities. And so they are the people that are the most affected, but they are also, interestingly enough, the communities that are implementing the most inspiring prevention measures and territorial control and basically supporting one another and coming together as communities to say, we know that the state's not going to protect us, so we're going to do this ourselves. And I think some Indigenous communities in the United States are doing that as well.
Yeah, I heard there was a report with the Grifna people have been organizing and banding together to support and to protect their community as well. I know they face a lot of hardships coming from multiple different industries and their own government, but I've been reading on different reports and articles talking about how they've been one of the stronger communities trying to band together to support and to protect their own.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because they've set up like checkpoints going in and out of their communities. They fumigate everybody that's going in and out like vehicles. They also have traditional, they're teaching, doing workshops of traditional medicines. They're doing just like amazing things, but I think that that's like the long history that they've experienced of extreme marginalization and exclusion, and so they just kind of really got together, and it's hard. It's like not an easy thing that they're doing. But they just have that ability to know that we can't trust the government. We need to do this ourselves, and they're really doing it. And I find that very inspiring.
You mentioned that the Honduran Constitution has been suspended. Can you expand on other experiences that you've heard of that people are experiencing in Honduras when it comes to the government, whether it's been actual oppression, not just policies that have been implemented, but actual oppression people are experiencing and witnessing, not maybe just in Tegucigalpa, but anywhere throughout Honduras?
Yeah, so one of the things that's happening is when they imposed the lockdown and they partially suspended constitutional rights, they sent military and police all around the country to set up roadblocks and to set up military checkpoints. And so when you send an already very abusive state security forces to basically enforce a public, what is supposed to be a public health measure, you obviously are handing a lot of power to groups that are traditionally known to abuse that power. And they're also, and like it's important to mention that the U.S. or that the U.S. supports the Honduran military and the Honduran police. And so these state security forces are basically criminalizing people's need to go out onto the street that are unable to lock down, that need to go and work every day, even if they wanted to lock down to protect themselves. They just simply can't because they can't put food on the table. They need to sell something in the morning in the market to be able to then take that money and purchase their food in the afternoon and then take it home for their families. And so the military and police are all over the country and they've detained thousands of people. There's people who have gone out to protest the fact that there's no food aid coming to support people that need it. And they've shot live rounds at people. They've tear gassed people. And so there's just abuses happening all over the country, which were already happening before the pandemic started, but that have worsened because of the suspension of constitutional rights and extreme power that's being given to the military and the police.
Do you feel like the coronavirus has been an excuse by the Honduran government to basically push more power and their grip on the people?
Yeah, I think so. I think that a lot of people before the pandemic hit said that Honduras is run by a narco government, a narco military government. And so a lot of people are worried that the Juan Orlando Hernandez or Ho government, like you said, is going to use this opportunity to further militarize. They're even handing some administration of hospitals over to military now. And so this is definitely a reason. This pandemic has given the Honduran government more reasons to steal money through corruption and more reasons and more sort of not reasons, but justifications, false justifications to hand over more power to the military and police.
Yeah. And I feel like for our listeners, it's a lot to take in because right now I know everyone has their own issues and their problems, but I feel like this gives the people, our listeners, a little glimpse into another country of issues that are going on that everyone's struggles is a little bit different, but maybe for people, give them a little wider global expanse on what the coronavirus has done. And I know probably a lot of people are busy, but for those of our listeners who are wanting to know more information, where can they go to? Where can they find out more information, what's going on, or work that you're doing?
Sure. So people can look for us on Facebook, the Honduras Solidarity Network. We're also on Twitter, and our Twitter handle is @HondurasSol, S-O-L. And so people can seek information there. We put up regular updates every day. And I also blog at www.aquiabajo, which is a Spanish term.com. So people can find info there.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for taking the time to kind of explain what's happening in Honduras to our listeners.
Thank you so much, Christina, for the invitation, and stay well.
Oh, will do. Thank you so much.
Random environment of IBEW Local 124. Neither rain nor snow nor gloom of night shall keep us from our constitutional rights on strike. Those are words from a picket sign during what is most likely still the largest wildcat strike in United States history, the U.S. Postal Department strike of 1970. This March was the 50th anniversary of the strike, and postal workers are faced again with many of the same attacks and challenges that led to the strike back in 1970. The institution of the Postal Service actually dates back even older than the rest of the government, and as postal workers visit almost every residence in the country up to 6 days a week, they've been described as the human face of the United States government. In 1970, postal workers were not legally allowed to strike or even to collectively bargain. Eight national unions existed among postal workers, although none were recognized by the government. Wages, benefits, and working conditions were notoriously poor and dangerous. Long-standing aggravations and tensions were catalyzed into labor action by Congress's decision to grant postal workers only a 5.4% raise, less than the rate of inflation, a year after giving themselves a 41% raise. The strike, which would eventually include over 210,000 people, began in Brooklyn and Manhattan when, on March 17th, members of National Association of Letter Carriers Branch 36 voted a strike. The civil rights movement had swept through New York City and formed deep, lasting roots. Many of the earliest and most ardent workers involved in the postal strike were African American. Their hopeful, righteous militancy gave the strike a considerable amount of steam. As a wildcat strike, the strike was against the wishes of the union leadership, and facing potential legal consequences, leadership pleaded, unsuccessfully, for the workers to return to work. It took a lot of guts to walk out. Workers striking against the government faced fines of $1,000 a day, imprisonment of up to a year and a day, and immense loss, immediate loss of his or her job. President Nixon got on television and ordered the workers back to delivering the mail, but this actually backfired and spread the walkouts to another 671 locations across the country. Workers and other government agencies made it clear that any actions taken against the striking postal workers would trigger even broader unrest among government employees. President Nixon and the U.S. government were not sure what to do in such a complex and volatile situation, and the U.S. mail system was paralyzed with over 30% of its letter carriers on strike. The stock market plunged due to the strike's effect on trading volume. President Nixon issued another national television address on March 23rd, asking workers to return to work while also declaring a national emergency and deploying 24,000 National Guard to distribute mail in New York City. "We have the means to deliver the mail," he claimed. This proved to be a hollow threat, as soldiers with no relevant training were laughably and predictably unable to administrate the immense and complex system behind mail service. Many of the National Guard turned out to also be postal workers, and when ordered to train their fellow guard on how to do the jobs required for mail delivery, they only made a perfunctory work-to-rule effort to comply. It turns out the government actually needed its workers. The strike ended after 8 days with President Nixon negotiating with union leaders, and reportedly not a single worker involved was fired. Groundbreaking concessions were won in stages. After around a month of negotiations, a 6% raise was granted. That summer, Nixon signed the Postal Reorganization Act, which gave postal workers an additional 8% raise, the right to collectively bargain, and the right to an arbitration process for contract disputes. Notably, postal workers, like all federal employees, were still prohibited from striking. After almost 200 years, the U.S. Postal Department was given a retooling into its more contemporary corporate incarnation, the United States Postal Service. Once again, Postal Service as we know it and her workers are under attack. Lola Reed, a letter carrier involved in the 1970 strike in St. Paul, said of the mentality of her co-strikers, "Most of us didn't expect to return to work. We thought that we would lose our jobs, but things would be better for those who replaced us." Have a great evening, everyone.
And now, this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. I'm Judy Ansel. And tomorrow night, May 15th, Friday, 7:30 to 9:30, there's a People's Music Network honors the life of and music of John Prine. This is on Facebook, and you can watch it and listen to it if you go to facebook.com/People's Music Network. Moore Squared is having a meeting on Kansas Issues. Kansas Issues to Action meeting, Monday, May 18th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Go online to Moore Squared Facebook page, and it'll tell you how to join. The Jobs with Justice monthly organizing committee meeting is Tuesday, May 19th at 6:30 p.m. If you want to attend that, contact Jameson at Jameson at mojwj.org in order to be given the link to the Zoom meeting. And you heard it at the break in the show, May 21st, KKFI, Jobs with Justice, and the Kansas ACLU are showing the film Rigged, the Voter Suppression Playbook. It's a film and panel discussion, 7 p.m. for the film, 8:15 for the panel discussion. Go to the KKFI website, go to kkfi.org/rigged, and you can register. That's it. You can find our calendar on our Facebook page, the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is, we're going to be interviewing Emily Twarag on her new book, Politics of the Pantry, and Jessica Padola. She paints the future for labor. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.